The world is cruel, and the only morality in a cruel world is chance. Unbiased, unprejudiced.
It's Innate, a podcast by two developmental psychologists for developmental psychologists and everyday folk with an interest in infant and child development. I am Candy LePan.
And I am Dion Benton, and we are the It's Innate podcast. Welcome back for another, this is episode four now?
Yeah, I know.
Wow. I think we're getting the hang of this podcasting thing.
I think we are. It's becoming much more natural. Yeah. I'm enjoying it.
Yeah, I agree. Now that I've gotten the audio thing figured out and we have a good list of topics on the docket, I think we definitely are making some headway on this podcasting. So, hey, if this professor thing doesn't work out, we have a fallback, right?
We have an alternate job plan. Yeah, we'll just be full-time podcasters. I like it.
Exactly, right.
We've definitely got the kinks worked out.
Expatriates from the academia, from academia. So what we wanted to start doing in our podcast is, before we actually get into the main topic, we want to just sort of discuss sort of hot topics, things that people are talking about that pertain to infant and child development, just to make the episodes a bit more interesting, and just to give you, the listener, more to listen to. Mm-hmm. And so today we wanted to talk about, so Candy and I are both professors. I am a visiting assistant professor at Swarthmore College in Philadelphia, and Candy is a professor at Wingate, an assistant professor at Wingate. And as professors, one of the things we have to think about is how we intend on teaching and what our university policies are on sort of teaching in person versus online versus a sort of a hybrid approach. And so we thought we would talk about that, as well as about, our opinions on and our ideas about school reopenings, whether or not we think it's a good thing, a bad thing, So yeah, that's sort of how we want to talk about. That's how we want to open up the first bit of this episode, and then the second part of the episode, we're going to be talking about some seminal studies spearheaded by Kylie Hamlin that looked at infants' ability to evaluate characters on the basis of their prosociality. So an infant's ability to say that something is good or to say that something is bad, or to at least indicate that something is good or something is bad based on their actions in different kinds of video events and live puppet events. So yeah.
Yeah, so we're going to jump into our hot topic first. This is something that I think is being discussed a lot in academia. We have universities all over the country and all over the world that are having to make these decisions. And this is an issue for K-12 schools too, but we're going to talk a bit about universities because that's the world that we live in. I guess first I just want to say what are universities doing? So I'll give you a little bit of background into why I've been going back and forth about this decision. So we are, at our university, we're reopening. But the decision of how your classes are going to be run has been left up to individual faculty members. So we were basically told you can teach face-to-face if you want completely, you can teach a hybrid course, or you can teach completely online. And so I felt a whole lot of pressure in making that decision. I was like, okay, all of a sudden I need to make sure that I'm an expert on health and safety, which I am not, and try to decide whether or not teaching face-to-face is worth it and a safe decision to make. So I've been really agonizing over that quite a bit. What's your university doing, Dion?
Yeah, so like you, so my university, Swarthmore, is sort of doing the same thing that your university is doing. So they're giving us the option to either teach face-to-face, to either teach remotely, fully remotely, or to do a hybrid approach. And like you, I've been agonizing over whether to teach either fully remotely or to do sort of a hybrid approach. I will say that I'm less inclined to teach fully remotely. And my sort of reasoning, my rationale is that, so I will say that the approach that I'm leaning towards is a hybrid approach. The reason I'm leaning toward the hybrid approach is because it allows me to have face-to-face time with students. And anybody who's a professor or who's a teacher knows that there's something about being able to see your students in person and being able to read their facial expressions and sort of being able to respond and to tailor one's teaching based on their level of comprehension that you don't necessarily get in an online format. And so I was, at least once this sort of these options were presented to me, I was at least at the beginning, was quite certain that I'm not going to teach fully remotely. Again, because by doing that, it would, like, there are certain challenges. Moreover, there's quite a bit of research showing that students do, in fact, learn better in sort of face-to-face settings. Yeah. And so, in making the decision to, so my decision, at least the one that I've sort of mentioned to my university, my college, is that I'm going to do a hybrid approach. And again, that decision is based on the fact that I want to put my students in the best possible position to succeed. Mm-hmm. And also I want to, I think that sort of face-to-face interaction, especially during this time, during a pandemic, is quite crucial. Yeah. Now, like you, I'm not an expert in health and safety. And so this raises another challenge. Like, you know, I have to think about how best to care for myself and to look out for myself, but also to sort of look out for my students and put them in the not only the best possible position to succeed academically, but also ensuring that the classroom setting itself is safe. And so this is definitely something that isn't easy. It's something I've been agonizing over. It's not clear what the answer, if there is a true answer, what the answer is. Yeah. And so, yeah, it's difficult, And what sort of makes it a bit more difficult for me is that this is my first, technically my first semester, teaching as a faculty. And so not only do I have to grapple with sort of learning the ropes with respect to teaching, now I have to sort of learn, become an expert in things beyond sort of just
that
teaching.
That is a very rough start to your first time teaching. I can't imagine having to think about and put together. It's so much work to think about online or hybrid classes. Either way, it is a lot of work. Face-to-face teaching is as well, but it just presents a lot more challenges and I think takes a lot more time. So I'm sure that has been rough for you as your first time teaching. I also initially agreed to do hybrid teaching. So I think this also maybe depends on where we are in our universities too. So I'll just give context that I work at a very small university. We have a little bit under 4,000 students. Most of our classes are always around 30 students in the psychology department. We have very small classrooms. There are probably only a handful of lecture halls in our whole university. And so we have small buildings, small classrooms. So an ability to social distance in those spaces is quite limited. And so right now our university has been closing off or putting capacity limits of about 50% on most of our rooms. So our rooms would have about 15 or so, 14 to 15 students in a classroom usually. Is yours about the same, Dion? Is it Swarthmore?
Yeah, so Swarthmore is about that size. And their approach, again, is similar to your university's approach. And so they're limiting classrooms to no more than 20 people. Mm. Moreover, they're leaving it up to the professors, the faculty, to decide whether or not they want to impose an additional limit. And so when I am teaching, what I'm limiting my classrooms to are 8 people.
Wow.
And so like Wingate, the university, the classrooms are quite small. And so it's a bit more difficult to physically distance. And so my solution is basically to cut down the number of students even more. And so what that means for me is that I'm going to divide my students, my classrooms, in either thirds or whatever, and then have the students rotate by group, so that each group has an opportunity to show up in person. But moreover, you know, to keep the students safe, I'm not having them all show up at once, again, because they will be rotating. Yeah. And so that's sort of my solution. And I do know a few other faculty who are sort of doing more or less the same thing, where they're dividing their students, their classrooms up into halves or thirds or fourths, and then rotating the students, rotating the groups rather. Again, just to give each group an opportunity to learn in a face-to-face format. In addition, what I'm doing is I'm recording the sessions.
Yeah.
So that the students who aren't like physically there, they'll have access to, you know, that day's lecture material. But in addition to that, I'm also going to be hopefully streaming the actual lecture session live.
Yeah.
And then those who can attend, who are in the States, who are within the time zone, can attend. But if not, that's fine, because again, I'll be releasing the actual lecture video, you know, to the class once the lecture is up for that day. So that's my approach.
Yeah, that was similar to what I was going to do. My class is supposed to meet only 2 days a week, so I didn't have... I mean, you could split it up over 3 days, but it would be a little bit more difficult in terms of timing rather than a class that was scheduled to meet 3 days a week. So I was just going to rotate half of my students every other class session. So it'd be about 14 students in the classroom. Again, I keep saying initially, and I say that because I have since changed my mind. So I live in North Carolina, and I think that looking at local level data was important for me. And so in tracking our numbers in North Carolina in the past like couple weeks, rather than our numbers declining for cases, hospitalizations, deaths, our numbers have risen significantly. Mm-hmm. We have like a massive increase of once our restaurants started opening back up and things like that, numbers have just been going way, way up, and we've had all time highs for all of those different indicators. And so it was at that point that now we're literally only a couple weeks away from students starting to come back to campus. And then I started thinking about that. I'm like, okay, well, when one of my students gets COVID, we'll have to probably then move online. Or if I get COVID, it's just,
yeah.
So I finally, yeah. I agonized over it, and I made the decision to move mine fully online because of that.
Gotcha. Yeah. I was going to ask, like, if you decided to stick with the sort of hybrid approach,
yeah.
Like how did you plan on going about lecturing? Like, did you plan on lecturing with a mask on,
yep,
with a shield on, with a mask and shield?
Yeah. I was just going to, I was just going to wear a mask. All students would be required to wear masks in the classroom. My approach then even was going to be not to really, it wasn't like a time for lecture. I was going to record lectures and put them up online. I was thinking of the in-person as more like, I'm not sure if you're familiar with supplemental instruction sessions,
yeah,
but basically like an SI session where we do, yep, some activities and answer questions and have discussion in person rather than really lecture about the material. And they would be expected to have watched the lectures ahead of time. I do a lot of active learning strategies in my class. And so those just don't, like, lecture works fine online. Like, I can post recordings of my lectures and students can watch them and that would be the same. But it's that interaction and the activity and discussion that's really hard to replicate online because students just, as you said, based on data, but also from my experience teaching online, students just don't get as engaged in that.
Yeah.
It's hard to replicate there. So that's what I was going to do in those sessions. You know, if things change over the course of the semester, I can still offer those. There's nothing stopping me, mm-hmm, from, like, later on, if things get better, I can, you know, reserve a classroom for myself and offer those sessions to students. That's not a problem. But I just couldn't do it at this point. It made me feel really like I was putting my students in a bad position and myself in a bad position, in a dangerous position. And I ended up emailing my students, and I was like, I know that you all are probably really disappointed about this, but I'd rather you be disappointed and alive than the opposite. So.
Exactly, right. Yeah, no, so what I plan on doing is I plan on buying a hazmat suit and, you know, wearing a shield and a face mask and some tape, and, you know, I'm going to war when I go to lecture. No. I definitely thought about recording my lectures, but again, sort of, I was sort of wrestling with that solution as well. And the reason why is because, like, yeah, I guess the students can, like, you could record lectures and then post those lectures and have the students watch the lectures. But the problem is that it's hard to tailor one's lecture to the dynamics of a classroom. And, you know, you've taught for some time now, and you've been a student for your whole life, you know, more or less. And so within any given session, you know, you're going to have students who get it. You're going to have students who don't get it. And I think the best professors, the best faculty are those who can adjust on the fly.
Yep.
And I just can't see recording, like being able to do that through a recorded lecture. And so that's why I've decided to, you know, risk at least my life one day a week. So I'm teaching. So my like you, I'm teaching twice a week. And so my approach is on Tuesdays, I'm going to, and my courses are on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And so I intend on lecturing on Tuesdays. And then on Thursdays, it'll be sort of discussion. It'll be applying the concepts from Tuesday's lectures. So they'll have a bit of lecturing, but also a bit of active learning. And I'm hoping that, you know, between those two mediums, they learn what they're meant to learn. But again, I mean, there's no one size fits all.
No.
And it's not, and there's, it's not like there's a right answer, sort of what works for you, you know, what, your university is requiring or college is requiring of you. And there's sort of all sorts of moving variables that you have to keep in mind. So yeah, I mean,
it's a hard choice, and I agree. Yeah. I don't think there's like any one right decision, and it's definitely not one size fits all. Everywhere has, you know, different things that are happening and different student populations. And I can't imagine what this is like trying to figure out at universities like that have lecture halls with 700 students and like, what do you do there?
Yeah. I should mention that Swarthmore, another thing that Swarthmore is doing, which I think is actually a great idea, is that they're inviting the freshmen and sophomores back for the fall semester, and they're telling the juniors and seniors to sort of, you know, do remote.
Yeah.
But then in the spring, they're inviting the juniors and seniors back, and the freshmen are basically switching places.
Hmm.
And the rationale is that, well, the seniors are going to be graduating.
Right.
And so, you know, while it's unfortunate that they won't be able to be on campus throughout the entire academic year, at least they'll be on campus during the semester that they're meant to graduate.
Yeah.
And so that was a sort of rationale. And I think it's a good idea.
I mean, if it's cutting your student population quite significantly.
Yeah, exactly.
And then also it's probably something that's flexible where, like, if, you know, if spring comes and things are much better, then maybe they invite everybody back. Like, I think the biggest thing that you have to deal with in the current situation is just unknowns and change. That's, like, always going to happen. At this point, none of us have really dealt with anything like this before. So making these decisions, things are going to change sometimes, the plans that we have, and we have to adjust them. So, yeah, it's been rough. I put out a poll on Twitter out of curiosity to see what other people thought. And so I just asked, you know, if people think that universities should actually allow face-to-face classes in the fall. And I did give options of yes, no, and it depends, but comment details of why it depends, which of course most people didn't respond. but we got about 70% of people said no, we shouldn't allow face-to-face classes in the fall. And then about 23% said it depends, 6% said yes.
Yeah, I was among the 23%.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like a strong, like my choice of it depends wasn't a strong conviction, you know, because I can actually see it going, you know, I could have just as easily chosen no.
Yeah.
But my rationale for choosing it depends is that it really depends on one's numbers.
Yeah.
But even in making that argument, I realized that people travel. And so even though, so let's say that your numbers start to show a decline, you know, if other places, other surrounding regions catch wind of that, they're, you know, and assuming that your region doesn't have any travel ban policies in place, there's nothing to stop people from traveling to those locations that are experiencing a bit of respite. Mm-hmm. And so even in saying it depends, I sort of want to append an asterisk to that because, you know, there's no policies in place that, you know, are preventing people from traveling across borders and across states. And I think that makes the calculus, the decision about whether to open up fully or, I mean, to teach in person, to teach remotely, it makes it just way more difficult. Oh, yeah. This is a very difficult situation, needless to say.
I sort of think it's like a big experiment. And unfortunately, we're not going to know what the right decision is until it happens. And schools are going to open soon. And then we're going to track and see what numbers look like then and what happens. And I hope that it's okay. It's been something that's been weighing on me for sure. And I know a lot of other people. So I thought it was a good question to ask and see what people were thinking.
It's a great question. You know, what pisses me off is that, you know, we could have had a handle on this.
Oh, yeah.
A long time ago.
Yeah.
All it would take is for us to buckle down for, you know, 6 to 8 weeks, according to the experts at CDC, for us to get a handle on this virus. But people aren't willing to do that, you know, and that's just exacerbating the situation. And also people are politicizing things that shouldn't be politicized, like masks, you know, and like you and I have discussed, I think that your freedom of speech stops when your freedom of speech could potentially pose a risk for another person. And while it's uncomfortable to wear masks, sure, I readily acknowledge that, like, And trying to wear a mask with glasses and sort of, it's like, it's a wrap. Like you have, your glasses are fogged up and it's really just onerous. Like, but that's a small price to pay to ensure the safety of not only yourself and your family, but the safety of other people. But yet we have an administration that's politicizing this fucking issue and it's really, really irritating. It's like, we all want to return to normal. Moreover, you have an administration that's drawing parallels to countries where we shouldn't be drawing a parallel. Like, you know, Trump has said, oh, you know, Italy, they've opened up schools and they're doing just fine. Well, what's the difference between us and Italy? Their case numbers are way less than our number. Like, they're, like, hovering around zero now.
They had, like, serious quarantine. Like,
they had serious countrywide
required lockdown, quarantine, don't leave your house. Like, And services that provided things like bringing you groceries, like we don't have those things in our country. So even quarantine, like I understand that's difficult. Not everybody has money to have groceries delivered to their house, right? Like we don't have those services. Right. And so people still have to leave their home to either go to work and make money because we're not, you know, one stimulus check that was $1,200 that was given how many months ago now, you know, is not going to keep people from needing to go out and work. And it's just...
You mean 1,200 is not going to do very much in New York? Yeah.
What did that even cover for people in New York?
It might cover a door and a doorknob, like, maybe.
Like,
you know,
a quarter of your rent? I don't know. I'm sure it's really expensive. Right. But I think I want to go back to the point that you made about, you know, the idea of wearing masks and all of this, I think, comes down to a lot of what I've continued to have recurring thoughts and feelings about this, that a lot of this is about how much we care about other people. Like, it's about whether or not we are being selfish or selfless. And like something like wearing a mask is not really so much to protect myself, but to protect other people. And so I come back to again and again, the morality of what it is that we're dealing with, which is an interesting link to the research that we're going to talk today about moral thought and development.
Well, which is interesting because what we're seeing is directly at odds with the claims that are made in that paper.
Exactly.
But before we actually get into that paper, I want to sort of, you know, articulate a thought experiment. Yeah. Let's imagine that we get word from the government that we are about to be attacked by a foreign adversary. We have 2 or 3 hours to prepare. And let's say as part of that preparation, the government says, I should also mention that it's about 5 p.m., so we have a couple of hours until the sun sets. And let's say the government says, okay, well, we don't really have much time to prepare, so the best we can do is to have all of our citizens turn off their lights so that once the adversary makes their way into our region, there's no one to target because the city itself is dark. The region is dark. Mm. But let's say there's a prick who's like, fuck that, it's my freedom of speech. I'm going to watch TV. I'm going to turn on all my lights. And that very decision can cost the lives of thousands of people. And the reason I say that is because that's sort of how I think about this sort of mask wearing issue. Mm-hmm. Like, it shouldn't be an issue at all, mm-hmm. right? I mean, your decision to wear a mask is more, it has nothing to do with you. It has to do with me, and it has to do with you and other people. Mm-hmm. And by not wearing masks, you're putting lots and lots of people's lives at jeopardy, even if your own life.
Yeah.
Even if you have perfect health, mm-hmm. you're putting other people's lives at jeopardy. And when you think about it that way, it highlights this sort of the stupidity of certain people. I'm sorry to be frank, but just to be frank, I mean, some people are dumb, and it's like, hey, you know, your inconvenience should come second to the lives and the safety of everybody else.
That's my point that I'm trying to articulate is that oftentimes that's our first jump, is that people are unintelligent and that's why they're not wearing a mask. But I don't think that it is. I feel like it's an issue of selfishness and like a lack of moral judgment, like a lack of a moral compass, that people are choosing not to wear a mask because they're more concerned about their freedom than other people's well-being. And so I think that it's...
Surely there's a link between morality and intelligence, though. And,
well, that might be another episode.
Perhaps there's a link. I don't know. I'd like to think that there's a link because I like to think like, yeah, I don't consider myself to be any Einstein or anything like that, but I at least know that, hey, my decision, like, yeah, it's uncomfortable to wear a fucking mask, but like, I'm doing it because I am looking out for everybody else. And like, it's a no-brainer. It's a no-brainer.
It should be, but you know, we see it's a
like, especially when you turn on the TV and you see that 150,000 people have died. Like, there's nothing about this that like should warrant opposition to something as simple as wearing a mask. It's not like I'm telling you to walk around with shackles on your ankles, yeah. and like tape on your eyes and like, I'm not asking anything ridiculous like that. I'm the thing that would help us to get out of the situation the most quickly is what people aren't wanting to or willing to do. Mm-hmm. And as such, we find ourselves in the situation debating about what sort of the best teaching approach is.
Yep.
This shouldn't even be a conversation, but yet it's a conversation we're having because of...
I know in our schools, at our university, for example, like I said, masks are mandatory. So like, there's no discussion about like, if you are going to do face to face, like everybody that's in that classroom has to wear a mask. And I don't think that's, I've just seen also non-compliance, even in places that do that, like going to a grocery store or something where signs are posted that like, you have to wear a mask. And there's not really much enforcement of that, because I certainly still see people wandering around the grocery store without a mask, even though it says that they should be. So it's definitely still an issue.
Yeah. Yeah.
So do you think that we have an innate moral compass then, Dion?
I mean, I as a scientist, I'm obliged to look at the data. And I'm inclined to say no.
No.
I'm inclined to say no, but other people say otherwise. Yeah. And I think that's the transition right there.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about some of that research then. I remember as a student, so this goes back to being an undergraduate student in my first ever college psychology course, developmental psych, taught by the person who ended up becoming my grad advisor, Janet Bozziowski.
Shout out.
And she taught us about these studies by Kylie Hamlin, this first one being from 2007, right?
Mm-hmm. There's actually an earlier one by Kohlmeier, Wynn and Bloom, I think. Mm-hmm. But this is probably the one you're referring to, I think, is the most well-known
one. Yeah. So this was published in Nature. We're not picking on Nature, I swear. We just happened to pick papers that happened to come from Nature that we were interested in. But I learned about this in this class, and I was really interested, along with Karen Wynn's work that we talked about before, And again, was just really interested in what are the conclusions that we can draw from this research. And so for, again, for our readers, or readers, for our listeners that...
Well, they could also be reading,
you might
right?
be reading.
And that's the hope, right?
For our readers or listeners. If you're not familiar, Kylie Hamlin, this was Kylie Hamlin and Wynn.
Kylie Hamlin, Wynn, and Bloom.
Yeah, that conducted...
07.
Yeah, that conducted this study. And what it's looking at was infants' socio-moral judgments or beliefs. And so this is a pretty simple paradigm. So babies are set up to watch and be habituated to two different types of events. It's sort of this display. This is probably hard to imagine in your mind, but as I describe it, it's like a hill, a little mm-hmm. mountainside with like one mountain peak and then another. and then there are geometric shapes with eyes that, you know, move along this mountain. And so there are helping events and hindering events. So in a helping event, one of the little shapes is trying to seemingly get up the hill and tries but can't. And then another shape.
I think they call it the climber.
The climber.
The climber and the helper. Yeah.
Yeah. So the climber's trying to get up the hill, but they can't do it on their own. So you'll see them try to go, but they come back down and try to go and come back down. And then the helper comes along and pushes the climber up the hill. And then when they get to the top, they're happy. So they bounce up and down because they have reached their goal. On the opposite end of that, you have hindering events where, again, you have a climber that's trying to get up the hill, but this time you have a hinderer that then bops the climber on the head, sort of, and bumps them down the hill. I think they roll at the end, right? Is that correct? They do a rollover at the end, then because they got bounced down the hill.
Right.
And what this paper found was that then later on in reaching events, correct? And these are, we should situate, Dion, ages were...
Yeah, these were 6 and 10 month olds. And I think it might be worth being also mentioning that they were habituated to both events.
Yes, exactly.
So they were, these 6 and 10 month olds, they were repeatedly shown both helping events mm-hmm. as well as hindering events.
Yep.
And they were shown these events until their looking times dropped, until they were bored.
Yep.
And then following habituation, Hamlin, Wynn, and Bloom had two measures of infant social moral evaluation. Mm-hmm. So one was a looking time measure. And so in the looking time paradigm, in the looking time test event, rather, the infants were shown either a test event in which the climber approached the helper, mm-hmm. As well as a second event where the climber approaches the hinderer. Mm-hmm. And infants, the amount of time that they spent looking at both events were assessed. Mm-hmm. And in the manual choice measure, I believe they were simply given the choice between the helper or hinderer.
They put the objects on sort of like a board. They were like stuck to the board, and they present the board to the infant and allow them to reach for one of them.
Right. And here, I'll let you want to spell out the results?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's what I'm assuming, the authors expected was that, infants sort of in their interpretation of this being a violation of expectations and the looking time measure, that infants looked longer when the climber approached the hinderer than when the climber approached the helper. So that they were surprised, perhaps. That is maybe the language that was used. They were surprised when the climber approached the hinderer, because why would you approach somebody that, you know, hindered your goal that you were trying to achieve?
And this is only for the 10-month-olds.
Yes.
So the 6-month-olds, at least in terms of their looking, they didn't discriminate the two test events. So they didn't seem to be surprised when the climber approached the hinderer, nor were they, you know, they weren't surprised by, mm-hmm. by those events.
They didn't have a difference in looking time to either of the events. Yeah.
Yeah, the 6-month-olds. Right?
Yeah, the 6-month-olds. But in the choice paradigm, they saw this result for both age groups, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yep. So in the choice result, both the 6 and the 10-month-olds
reach for the helper.
Chose the helper. Mm-hmm. Right. And so what,
I just wanted to give a quote for the interpretation then of these findings. These were the findings mm-hmm. that they had, and they in this paper they propose that the capacity to evaluate, this is a direct quote, the capacity to evaluate individuals on the basis of their social interactions is universal and unlearned. Mm-hmm. So that was the
right, and then they go on to We should also mention that they in a so this experiment itself consisted of three the study ex- consisted of three experiments, mm-hmm. and so the second experiment was meant to determine whether or not the effect in experiment one was due to sort of the social aspects mm-hmm. or whether it was due to some sort of low level perceptual features. Mm-hmm. So the second study was more or less the second experiment was more or less identical to the first experiment, except that the climber was replaced with like a pincer. A tool that you use to grasp other objects. Mm-hmm. And what they find basically is that there's no difference in looking. Or I think they did. So in the second experiment, the measure wasn't actually looking. It was choice.
Yeah.
So there was no difference in the infant's choice of the helper or hinderer. Mm-hmm. Experiment three then went on to look at, what aspect of these helping and hindering events infants were attending to. So, of course, one explanation is that, well, the infants may well have had a bias for positive stimuli, and so therefore they were only attending to the helping events, or they could have had a bias or an aversion, rather. And I think the term they used was an aversion or averse. Mm-hmm. They could have been averse to the hindering events and showed a bias against the hinderer. And so experiment three was similar to experiment one, except that instead of habituating infants to helping and hindering events in alternation, the infants were habituated to either helping neutral events mm-hmm. or hindering neutral events. Mm-hmm. And what they find is that for the infants, these are 6 and 10 month olds again, for the infants who were habituated to alternating helping and neutral events, the infants subsequently showed a preference for the helper over the neutral character. Mm-hmm. Whereas for the infants who were habituated to hindering neutral, they showed a preference for the neutral character over the hinderer. Mm-hmm. And these together were the findings that made up that particular experiment. And on the basis of these findings, like Candy was saying, the conclusion was that these infants have this sort of capacity to, what did you say? What were the exact term? What was the exact sort of phrase?
Just to make sure we're quoting, the capacity to evaluate yeah. individuals on the basis of their social interactions is universal and unlearned.
Yep.
Yeah. So a hefty claim. The studies are very interesting. And I think, and this mm-hmm. is again a paper from 2007. Hamlin and her colleagues have done a lot of research in this area since, and different versions, many different like manipulations and versions of this task. From work from her lab has found, I would say, relatively consistent results mm-hmm. Using this paradigm, as well as another that's sort of similar with helping and hindering events using puppets and trying to open mm-hmm. containers. But we also found some other research that didn't replicate these findings, or that suggests maybe other interpretations of what might be driving some of the results that you see in her work.
Well, before we get
yeah,
to
yeah, I have
that
some other
paper,
things. Yeah.
Okay. I was going to say, before we get to that paper, maybe we should talk about some of our critiques
sure.
of the Hamlin, Wynn, and Bloom study.
Yeah.
But I agree. I will say before we get into that I think this study does a decent job at trying to get at this question of whether infants possess this capacity, this social moral evaluation capacity. Mm-hmm. And they do. The reason I say that I think they did a decent job is because they have controls and they acknowledge alternative explanations. Mm-hmm. And the statistics are a bit stronger than the statistics in the math study that we discussed two episodes ago. So I want to start off by sort of acknowledging what I think the study did right. Mm-hmm. And I think that their thoroughness in evaluating this question is to be commended. Nonetheless, I think that there are some issues with this study that I think merit caution mm-hmm. Or sort of that sort of require caution before arguing that babies have this capacity to distinguish between good and bad characters, and that this capacity is supposed to be universal and unlearned. And so maybe we should, you know, we should talk about some of those reasons.
Yeah, sure. And I mean, there are some basic ones that we always, you know, I always have to point out, and I understand always that infant research is hard, child research is hard. But just to point out that in this original study, in some of these conditions, the sample sizes are super small. Like in some of, I read at least one of them that had a condition with only 8 participants, like in a particular cell size. So just there, I would be a little bit cautious in most of these findings and making, again, it's about the matching of the data to the claims. So right. Claiming that something is mm-hmm. universal when you studied, a very small number of infants from a very specific background. I don't imagine this was also probably the most diverse background of infants. It was that info is not in the paper because it's a Nature paper. It's super short.
Most likely New Haven infants.
Yeah, probably.
And I had a discussion with, so this is actually a topic. This is interesting. Maybe this could be an episode in itself, but I've had conversations with other developmental psychologists about possible effects of location.
Oh, yeah.
And how, like, one of the reasons why some of these studies of these classic, some of these replication attempts of these classic studies fail is because they're not sampling mm-hmm. the right kind of infant. So perhaps New Haven infants are just qualitatively different than infants in Phoenix. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just an arbitrary comparison, but maybe there is something to do with location, and part of the failures to replicate have to do with both the low sample size, which necessarily makes one wonder about whether or not the effect is maybe a false positive, but also whether or not some of these effects are being driven by effects of location.
Well, yeah, and I think when we're talking about, you know, things that might be impacted by perceptual biases or just perceptual differences, the fact that we have, you know, different locations where the things that infants see might be different. So like, do you live in the desert, right? Or you live in a very rural area where you don't see like a lot of buildings with like vertical lines that go up into the air. Like that might be something very different for infants. There are different perceptual things that you could learn based on living in different areas. I think also,
and even within the same area, you have differences having to do with SES.
Yep.
And so if there's one thing we do know about the effect of SES, like that sort of infants who are born to parents who are of higher SES just have richer experiences.
Oh, yeah.
And it may well be the case that what we're seeing in some of these studies, just by the nature of where these studies were conducted, we're seeing probably some effect of SES.
Oh, yeah.
Where these kids are, these infants are, you know, they live in these sort of rich in both senses, environments that afford them all sorts of opportunities. Mm-hmm. That sort of we're picking up on when we do these studies, mm-hmm. That other infants in other places who aren't born to parents of the same sort of socioeconomic status may not receive those sorts of benefits.
Yeah.
And as a result, we, you know, maybe sort of failing to, or those studies, that may be an explanation for why those studies fail to replicate some of these more seminal studies.
Yeah. And, right? And I mean, not to keep harping on the, theory of puppets chain that went around, but part of that was not just talking about the idea that we use puppets as stimuli, but it was talking about the idea of universality of findings and generalizations that we make based on weird samples. So for those that don't know, that means Western, educated, industrial, rich and democratic locations and subjects. And that's typically what our subjects are in our studies. And so in other cultures and other places around the world, those children might not have the same experiences with like the toys and stimuli that we use in these studies. And so that could be something that's learned over time and that affects like their ability to perform or the way that they perform in these studies. So I think it's really, I think that part in particular was really stood out to me. Is saying that this would be something universal based on such a small and probably not very diverse sample of participants. But yeah, what other things did you, what other critiques did you have, Dion? Those are my low level, standout obvious things probably. We shouldn't say things are universal if we only had a really small, not diverse sample.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so I mentioned an article that was written by Talia Arcone called The Generalizability Crisis. Mm-hmm. And while I don't agree with everything he says in that article, mm-hmm. the one thing I think I do agree with is this sort of idea that if your sample consists of a certain population, so in this case, weird infants, mm-hmm. You're only licensed to make generalizations that apply to that population. And it's only when you sample either a larger population or you intentionally sample both weird kids and kids across in different places that you are licensed to make these broader generalizations. But yet when psychologists, this is sort of true irrespective of particular field in psychology, yet when psychologists run these studies, our generalization intent is to generalize to the world, to the population. Mm-hmm. That decision may be erroneous. Mm-hmm. Because again, what we're showing may be effects of the particular sample that we've tested. And so we have to be cautious before making these broad sort of generalization claims. So before I actually get into what for me was one of the bigger issues, I want to sort of mention another nitpicky point. So there's really no, in the study, they use two different measures of social moral evaluation. So they use a looking time measure, and they use a choice measure. Yeah. So that's true in experiment one, but then in experiment two, they go to a choice measure and they just drop the looking time measure. And there's no justification was given for that drop in looking time mm-hmm. measure. And for me, the reason that's particularly problematic is because experiment two was framed as a kind of replication of experiment one. So if it's a replication of experiment one, I would think that you would want to replicate experiment mm-hmm. one as closely as possible by not only ensuring the procedure itself is as close to the procedure in experiment one, but also using the exact same measures to see if there's replicability in the measures themselves. So there's no explanation that no justification that was given for the use of different measures. And so to me, that sort of
especially because that's not something that's like extra you'd have to do. You would have that data.
Well, if I had to make an argument for why they didn't do that, just to be fair, just to be charitable, I think it's because the six-month-olds failed to show discriminatory looking. Mm-hmm. And so if you recall in the looking time right. measure, the infants looked equally long at both helper mm-hmm. and hinderer events. And it could have been on this basis they chose to not use that measure. But I don't actually think that explanation was given. And so I would have at least appreciated an explanation mm-hmm. for why one of the measures was sort of dropped.
Right. Yeah,
so that's sort of a minor point that I wanted to mention. But for me, I think the bigger issue has to do with the interpretation mm-hmm. of these data as supporting the claim that infants are discriminating between good guys and bad guys. Mm-hmm. And my criticism in particular is that in addition to manipulating, helping, and hindering across the two events, there is an additional confound. Yeah. And the confound is that there's a number of them, but I think this is a particularly problematic one. So it turns out that in the helping event, in addition to actually helping, that is, the helper helping the climber ascend the hill, the helper and the climber are moving in the same direction, almost like an entraining event where two things move together. Whereas in the hindering event, the two things are working in opposition to each other. So you have the climber trying to ascend and you have the hinderer trying descending and also moving in opposition to mm-hmm. the climber. And for me, the problem is that it may well be the case that in the real world, the infants see many more instances of agents. So remember, these are characters. These are stimuli with eyes. So eyes, we know from lots and lots of research that infants attribute things like eyes and legs with animate agent-like motion. Mm-hmm. And so it may well be the case that in the real world, infants see many more examples of agents with eyes or things with eyes moving with rather than against each other. Yeah. And so it may be on this basis that they're discriminating the New Testaments. And because this kind of motion wasn't controlled, it's hard to know whether or not the difference in looking and the difference in choice was a function of infants attending to, showing sensitivity to, helping and hindering per se, or to these, this sort of low-level explanation that is, in the helping event, the two things are moving together, which is consistent with their real-world experience, whereas in the hindering event, the two objects are moving in opposition, which itself is inconsistent with their real-world experience. And it could have been on this basis that they're discriminating the two testaments, which has nothing to do whatsoever with sort of social moral evaluations. And so to explore, so I wanted to actually explore this a bit more closely in the context of a computational model. So I was explaining to Candy that I was
Dion
up until
went
about
on a whole trip with this.
I went down the rabbit hole.
I brought him into the socio-moral world. And
yeah, I know. Right. Got him hooked. And yeah, so what I wanted to do was I wanted to explore, to implement this mechanistic account in a neural network, a feed-forward neural network. Basically, it's a computational model that learns to produce a certain kind of output. And so what I did, just like what the infants in the Hamlin, Wynn, and Bloom study were shown, they were so these models were habituated to, and I'm air quoting, habituated to helping as well as hindering events. However, prior to helping and hindering events, the networks were given real-world experience. The purpose of the real-world experience was to test the sort of claim that maybe one of the reasons the infants look longer at the hindering events is because that motion, that is the two characters moving in opposition to each other, is just inconsistent with their real world experience. So to test this mechanistic explanation, what I decided to do was I built a real world scenario whereby networks, I think 95% of the time they were shown events in which two things move together, agents with eyes move together. And then in the remaining 5% of the events, the objects with eyes moved in opposition to each other. And it turns out that after experience with these kinds of events, when you habituate an infant to the helping and hindering event and subsequently probe the network, the infant or the network, with whether or not they prefer the helper or the hinderer, the network preferred the hinderer. So how do we know the network preferred? So it turns out that because these aren't actual infants, we have to use other things as proxies for looking time and also choice measures. And so for anybody who's built neural network computational models of development, we often use error as a proxy for looking. So the more error the network shows to a particular example, the more we can say the network is actually looking. The longer the network is looking at that particular event, and it turns out that following this real world experience and this habituation experience, the networks look much longer at the hinderer events than the helping events. Well, because these are networks, these aren't people. They don't have, you know, these networks weren't, they didn't have wired into them, sort of this moral core, this moral sense. But yet their ability to discriminate between the two test events was largely a function of their real-world experience. And it turns out that if the networks, much like probably children, if they experience far more instances of agents moving together rather than against each other, they form this sort of bias. And this bias governs how they interpret subsequent habituation events and subsequent test events, such that the infants will be surprised when the helper approaches the hinderer, then when the helper approaches, or when the climber approaches the hinderer, then when the climber approaches the helper. And that's, again, because their real world experience was such that they experienced far more instances of things moving together. And so this sort of provides a kind of proof of concept that a domain general associative learning mechanism that has, that knows nothing about morality per se, can still give rise to findings like the Hamlin, Wynn, and Bloom finding, and sort of this sort of raises the question of whether the infants in the original study were in fact attending to morality per se, given that these networks, which know nothing about morality, much less anything else, were showing the same patterns of looking, so to speak, as these infants. Yeah. And so for me, that's the biggest issue. And I think sort of, in order to address an issue like this, you would have to, at the very minimum, control for that kind of sort of motion That is, you would have to have both helping and hindering events whereby both the climber and the helper, or the climber and the hinderer, moved in the same direction, but somehow manipulate helping and hindering.
Yeah.
Which, of course, is a difficult ask. I mean, it's not clear how you would go about doing that, but that's one way of getting at helping and sort of an infant sensitivity to helping and hindering per se, that avoids this confound.
Yeah, it's not an easy problem to address. And again, I think, like you said, I do commend Hamlin and her colleagues for trying. And again, they've been doing this work for years, trying to come up with different ways to address this. But I agree. I don't think that it's been addressed fully yet. And I certainly don't think it was addressed in this paper enough to make some of those claims that were made about what these findings really mean, because there's still a lot more that we need to know about other possibilities of motion, and like you said, whether or not these are driven by some sort of perceptual differences. Right. And that these are not, you know, we're not the only people to make these arguments.
Exactly.
There are lots of other people who have had similar critiques of the study as well. I also wanted to mention that.
Well, hold on, before we go on, I want to clarify exactly the mechanistic account. And also, the network makes a prediction that I didn't mention, but I think I should mention. So the mechanistic explanation that the network is providing is that throughout their experience, what the networks learn is that when they're shown two agents, two things with eyes, they come to expect that the two things will move together rather than against each other. So there's a sort of an associative link that's built, such that later on, when you show the networks, much like the children, when you show them two agents, they expect the two things to move together. Mm-hmm. And so when you show them an event where two agents with eyes move in opposition to each other, that's surprising, again, because in the real world, they would have built up this expectation such that two things with eyes move in accord with rather than in opposition to each other.
Yeah.
And so it's on the basis of the violation of this sort of associative link that the networks, at least, and presumably the infants, looked longer at the hindering event.
Mm-hmm.
I should also mention an interesting prediction that the network makes, a prediction that I don't think has ever been tested in the literature. And the prediction is that because this sort of differential looking to these two types of test events is likely due to networks and by extension infants seeing more real-world instances of agents moving together, than agents moving in opposition, the networks actually take much longer to habituate to hindering events. Again, because these events are at odds with mostly everything they've ever seen.
Yeah.
So they've ever only seen agents moving together rather than agents moving in opposition. And as a result, the networks take much longer to habituate to the hindering events and the helping events.
Hmm.
Now, the reason I say this kind of prediction hasn't been tested is because for anybody who knows this literature, the infants are habituated to both events, and both events are shown in alternation.
Mm-hmm.
So on one trial, they may be shown the helping event. On a second trial, they may be shown the hindering event. And so it's hard to know which of the two events infants are habituating to.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the network makes a particular prediction, and the prediction is that because infants likely experience far fewer instances of things moving against each other, they should take much longer to habituate to those events.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's definitely something that's worth looking at. And as far as my reading of my cursory reading of the literature, that sort of prediction has never been tested, again, because the infants are only ever habituated to these events in alternation.
Right. So we could have separate groups of infants that are habituated to just helping events, just hindering events, and then compare across and see how many trials or how long did it take for them to habituate to those. And we would expect then that it would take fewer trials to habituate to helping events than hindering events.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
The network also makes another prediction, and the prediction of this is quite intuitive, is that because this finding is likely a function of experience, real-world experience, it predicts that younger infants who are younger than 6 months of age, should failed to discriminate the two testaments because they wouldn't have had enough time to learn the relevant contingencies, to learn, for example, that for the most part, agents, whenever two agents are presented together, they tend to move together. Mm-hmm. And because by virtue of being younger, they wouldn't have had the time that they would need to learn that contingency. And so therefore, these infants should take about the same amount of time to habituate to both events, but moreover, they should fail to discriminate between the two testaments. Again, that's a function of them not having the kind of experience that older infants have with these two types of testament. Now, of course, this prediction is also at odds with this claim that infants possess an innate moral core, which is supposed to be present from early on, and it's supposed to be universal. Well, this prediction is what this prediction is saying is that there's a point in development where you shouldn't actually see discriminatory looking. And again, this is the result of them just not having enough experience with the relevant contingencies that make up these test events, that make up these events.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that it's definitely something that's still worth examining and looking at different possibilities and explanations. And we always can come back to this idea too of saying that at 6 or 10 months of age that something is unlearned because we find evidence of it. There's a whole lot of learning that can go on in especially 10 months, but even 6 months of life and those associations that can be built like you're talking about. So I think that there's still some more work to be done here.
The interesting
thing that I found when I was digging into some of this as well, again, not my specific area of expertise. I do sociomoral development with a bit older children. So I was digging into some of the other stuff that Hamlin and her colleagues have done since. And in one of her papers, she sort of addressed that claim that she made, that the capacity to evaluate individuals on the basis of social interactions is universal and unlearned, because another paper had criticized that claim. And her response to that, basically, I'll summarize at the end, she sort of talks about, you know, that this is just, this is a theoretical claim, and like, you know, that many people have made different types of criticisms and have investigated and sort of tested this claim now that it's been made, and people have different willingness to, you know, attribute these really rich explanations versus lower level interpretations based on perception. I mean, she ends by saying that that's whatever the current evidence for or against either theoretical stance, to the extent that such debate promotes rigorous empirical efforts to distinguish between alternatives, it can only benefit the field as a whole. So in other words, she's saying, like, whether or not this claim is true, it's beneficial because it promotes people asking questions and testing the claim.
Which is exactly how science should proceed.
Sure. But my criticism there is that making a claim that's so bold and not yet, you know, it wasn't a theoretical stance in the paper. It was a definitive sounding claim that this said, this is something that is universal and unlearned. I do think that it's not just beneficial. Like, it does obviously have drawbacks. Sure, certainly within the scientific community, it can be beneficial in the way that she described, but what about the dissemination to the general public? This maybe is not like an area that, you know, has hefty impacts on like parents or, you know, educators, but like when this type of claim like that is, you know, disseminated, just like maybe the Wynn study, it's like the headlines are babies can do math. Infants have infants make moral decisions, like, and that does get disseminated, not in the same way that it does within the scientific community. And so I do think that there is when we have to be more careful about the claims that we're making, because it's not just scientists that read these papers now. Like, journalists find scientific studies and then disseminate them to the general public. And when we have claims like that, they'll take those claims at face value. They don't take them as a theory or a possibility. They take them as a fact reported by a scientist. In one of the, you know, most prestigious journals, Nature, and then report that as a headline. Like, it's universal and innate that babies have social morals. And I think that that is problematic.
I think that's actually a good point. I mean, what you're getting at really is you're issuing a challenge to scientists to discriminate between the reception of a body of work within the scientific community and the reception in the real world. And most lay people aren't trained in the scientific method, and they don't realize that these claims may not, you know, hold up under scrutiny. They may have no idea of this notion of falsifiability, whereas scientists do. And because of the difference in reception, one should exercise caution before making these bold claims. The criticism you're making isn't necessarily about the claim itself. Mm-hmm. It's about whether or not the data support the kind of claim that you're making. Mm-hmm. And claims like babies can add and subtract, or babies have this sort of innate capacity to discriminate between good things and bad things. These are bold claims. Again, which are fine to make, but they mandate extraordinary evidence. Mm-hmm. And just from our sort of reading of these studies that we've read in preparation for this particular episode, it's unclear to me whether or not the data point to sort of show support for or corroborate the claim that infants possess an innate moral core, much less an innate one.
Yeah.
Right. And because of the difference in reception, I think you're right. I think it's important for scientists to keep that in mind and realize that, hey, you know, these claims, you know, can be easily taken up. And especially by people who aren't tutored in the methods and approach that we use to conduct these studies. And so while I agree with her, that these claims are falsifiable, it's unclear whether the general public sees it that way.
Yeah. And even within the scientific community, I think that just stating that in a different way, like it's a possibility that infants have this innate moral compass, like just phrasing it in that way can also, like, that will still generate research and debate and discussion and more studies. Like, you don't have to put forward a claim that's so definitive to generate that type of response. Like, that's not necessary. Just by saying that this is a possibility will still drive scientific exploration on the topic. So I don't see it as necessary, and I'm not sure why that would be the case. And I think that...
And it's a bit more faithful to the data.
Yeah, and I think that think that within the scientific community, we also... I never try to tie myself to a theory, like, until I have that type of evidence, which really has to be very overwhelming. And because I think that we all have our own biases. Like, if we really believe that and we buy into something and we really want to believe that it's true, we might frame something in a way that favors our perspective. And I think as scientists, we have to try to be as objective as possible, that like when I go into some type of research, like maybe I'm hoping that I prove myself wrong, you know, just to see what is the truth. So I don't know. Yeah, I think it's not as bold of a claim as that should be warranted. The other paper that we read in preparation was a direct replication attempt of this paper. I know Dion has some things to say about this as well. So these other researchers tried to replicate this paper by Hamlin and colleagues. And I'm probably going to butcher these names, but Laura Schlingloff, Cisbra, and Titone.
Chibra.
Zebra?
Chibra.
Chibra. Okay.
Chibra. Chia.
I need to meet them at a conference, and they can make sure that I get this right. I apologize if you're listening, any of these authors. So they replicated this Hamlin study. They actually, in the paper, said that they worked with...
They tried to replicate it.
They said that they worked with Hamlin and her colleagues to get information about the design of the study to make sure that it was as close as possible. I know that there were, however, some deviations.
That's a kind way of putting it.
And by Dion's face, I think that we're going to talk about some of those.
Yeah, that's a kind way of putting it. Deviations. That's a euphemism if I've ever heard one.
So to give the spoiler of what they found, which is that this was a failed replication. And so they didn't find differences in, this was for reaching, for the helper versus the hinderer. They found it was exactly 50% of infants reached for the helper versus the hinderer. So they didn't find any different, any difference there. They do note that this might be because of some of the differences in the stimuli or procedures that they used. But also that it might be some issues in terms of effect size of the actual finding and whether or not it might be replicable. Dion, do you want to go over what some of the differences then were?
Yeah, I mean, so I commend them for attempting to replicate this study. I mean, it deserves the kind of claims that are made in the study warrant a replication. Yeah.
And the sample sizes for replication.
And this exactly. So good on them for that. My concern, however, is that it's not clear to me what can be concluded from their failure to replicate, chiefly because there are a number of presumably critical differences between what was done in the replication attempt and what was done in the original study. Yeah. So, for example, this isn't that big of a concern, and I'll explain why, but it's still something that's worth thinking about. So in the original study, in the 07 study, 6 and 10-month-olds were tested, whereas in this replication attempt, 15-month-olds were tested. And maybe one of the differences may well have to do with the fact that they're testing 15-month-olds. Yeah. Now, of course, one can argue or object by saying, why would you expect the effect to be weaker with 15-month-olds than with 10-month-olds? But nonetheless, that's one difference, one of many differences. A second difference is that unlike the original study, which used habituation, the replication used familiarization.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So again, as a reminder for those who don't do infant research, there is a difference between the two. These two terms are often used interchangeably, but they actually have very different meanings. Mm-hmm. So habituation is often referred to as infant-controlled because the infant decides when they are bored and when the experimenter ought to present the test stimuli. Whereas with familiarization, the experimenter decides beforehand how many trials an infant will be exposed to, or how many trials of exposure to a particular stimulus that an infant will be shown. And we've discussed in previous episodes how there, like, that there are issues with using familiarization. So any subsequent, let's say, lack of looking or attending to one event over another may well be the result of a lack of familiarization. Mm-hmm. So to go back to the Cohen replication of the Wynn study, so what he's showing is that this finding that the babies look longer, the 5-month-olds look longer at the impossible event. So let's say the infant was habituated to a 1+1 event. The finding that the baby looks longer at an outcome of 1 than an outcome of 2 may well be the result of a lack of familiarization to the one event, the outcome of 1. And so maybe another difference, of course, that could account for the lack of a replication is the difference in habituation procedure. So again, in the Slingloff study, they use familiarization, and in the original study, they use habituation.
Yeah.
So that's just still another difference.
Yeah. And so I think that like in that Cohen study, and thinking about the idea of familiarization versus habituation, whether or not infants are like preferring to look at something novel versus something familiar, or whether they're bored with something, like you see different curvilinear, you know, patterns of looking based on like, how long did I really look at something and how long is it considered something novel versus something familiar? And so that is a really big difference, that one, they use habituation and one, they use familiarization. So whether or not, now, to be fair, their outcomes were not looking, but it's still relevant. It's still, you know, important.
Well, so to be clear, so in the original Wynn study, in the original Hamlin, Wynn, and Bloom study, the outcome was both looking and reaching, and the procedure that they used preceding those choices, either looking or actual a manual choice, was habituation.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And so, the reason I'm being picky about this is because they assert at the beginning of this article that this is a more faithful replication of the original Wynn study than other replications, but it's not. There are lots of other differences. Another difference.
The video stimuli, that's a big one.
Exactly, the video. So in the original study, the babies were shown live puppet shows, whereas in this particular replication, they were shown video recordings of puppet shows. And so the medium itself, so they do go on to argue how the medium, there's no effective medium.
Yeah, because I mean Hamlet.
You just can't be
sure. Yeah, you can't be sure.
You just can't be sure.
You can't be sure. They cite and say that some of Hamlin's other work found using these live shows versus video showed no difference in effects. But again, it's like if you really want to do a true replication of a study, like just truly replicate.
And that may well be the case. That may well be the case, but because other factors vary, yeah. There could be an interaction
thing going on. Too many things differing at one time.
Too many things differing, and they could interact in interesting ways to drive looking, and we don't know. And so for me, like, it's not clear what can be concluded from this failed replication. So it doesn't tell me anything.
Well,
maybe I'm being a bit more pessimistic than you would otherwise be.
Yeah, because I mean, I wouldn't say it doesn't tell me anything. I think it's not a direct replication, and I wouldn't.
It tells me to do a more faithful replication.
Yeah.
That's what it tells me.
I would say it doesn't. It's not a direct replication. I don't interpret it that way at all. I do interpret it as a conceptual replication.
But that's not how they frame it.
No,
they frame it
and I agree.
More faithful replication, which implies
direct. I know that that's how they frame it. I'm just saying my interpretation and what I can take away from it is more a conceptual replication, and it is a failed conceptual replication. Now, if you framed it that way, right, if I said this is a conceptual replication of this study, I would read it much more fairly, like, and much more positively. And in that sense, I can say that to me, this is at least one piece of evidence that conceptually we don't see the same pattern of results that Hamlin and colleagues found, right? Not a direct replication. This isn't exactly the same, but in a similar type of study, you don't find those findings. And so it does at least give me, never one study is going to like solve an issue, right? You have to look at a body of work over time. And I think that Hamlin and colleagues obviously do have a large body of work that I think does support them. But there are other studies now that sort of speak against that. And there were some other ones that came down the pipeline as I was reading through this literature too, that it does, to me, it's just, again, one more piece of evidence to say that this is a bit more mixed than it's presented, right? That, again, the evidence matching the claims, I don't think that we have evidence that this is completely universal and unlearned pattern of socio-moral judgments. I think that we have to really dig deeper to find something that might support that claim, because it seems a bit more mixed than that.
Yeah, but even on this, I'm going to sort of push back on this conceptual front. So even if we do interpret it like a conceptual replication, I'll grant you that. But even if I do interpret it that way, it's still not clear to me what can be concluded, because, like, at the very minimum, if it's a conceptual replication, at the very minimum, replicate the same, use the same ages.
Yeah.
But even the ages differ. Like, you can differ. Yeah. So I understand, like, there is value to conceptual replications. And not everything needs to be a direct replication. And if anything, I can make an argument for conceptual replications over direct replications. Conceptual replications are really nice because they allow you to get at the robustness of an effect, right, in ways that direct replications don't. But even if we interpret this study as a conceptual replication, even the ages differ. Yeah. Like, between the two studies. And so, like, what are they conceptually replicating?
So maybe not even a replication. Like, take that even out of the picture and just conceptualize this as another study on the same topic, right? Like, if you claim that this is an unlearned type of knowledge, age doesn't matter. That should be adding to the literature by looking at a different age group to say, do we see the same thing in older children? Which, in this case, you don't.
But even then, I would still push back. It's like, okay, if that's the path down which you'd like to go, test younger infants, not 15-month-olds. Why would you test if you're trying to look at if the claim you're trying to assess is the validity of this claim that infants possess an innate moral core that stipulates the principles that govern moral agents, then you would want to go younger, not older.
Yeah.
And so, like, with that in mind. Again, I'm sort of left with what can we conclude from this study? Even if we take, if we defenestrate with the terms replication, conceptual, direct, what can we conclude? They're going up in age, not down in age. And if we're trying to assess her principal argument, shouldn't you test younger
infants?
Sure,
I mean, I think that that's valid, and that's one way to go with it. But I don't think that it eliminates the idea of looking at older, because the claim should be valid for any age group then. If that's the claim that you're making, is that this is something that is innate, it would be present across age groups, and that shouldn't make a difference. I get what you're saying. I totally do. I just think there's still value in looking at different, the best study, right, is going to be a direct replication that has various conditions with younger age groups, the same age groups and older age groups. We might only chip away, right? This is the idea of, like, you're eating the elephant one bite at a time. It's a weird metaphor, mm-hmm. but, like, I think that's just looking at all of these. I don't know why they made the decisions that they did with ages and their materials. With materials, I always go back to the idea again, though, that, like, a slight change in materials or stimuli, if, like, your finding depends on some minutia of your stimuli, then it's not a robust finding. And that also gives me, like, pause to accept your claims. If this is, again, something so robust, then it shouldn't matter.
Now, this depends, of course, on one's argument. Yeah. So, like, if one is making a strong claim, then yes, you better show robust findings.
Yeah, exactly.
If you're hedging your bets, if you're saying it could be this, then it may well be the effect may well differ as a function of of varying these low-level variables.
I mean, and to think back to the original, like, this display, the way that it goes, like, all the stimuli used, it's completely arbitrary. Like, this is just what Hamlin and colleagues chose in their first study, and it's the same thing that's been used again and again, some other few other studies using different types of stimuli, like we mentioned earlier. But, like, so varying those stimuli, that's completely arbitrary. Hamlin could have happened to choose something completely different in her first study. So to me, you should see robust effects across different types of stimuli if this is really something so broad as infants making socio-moral judgments. So that's where,
Well, that's why I was making a case for conceptual replications.
Yeah, no, I agree.
So, like, conceptual replications are really the province to test the robustness of an effect. Yeah. But I still want to push back a little slightly on the 15-month-old claim. I'm still stuck on that. I'm, like, perseverating right now. I'm perseverating on that damn claim.
You don't think that it's valuable to, like, so, again,
no,
I get it.
Not in this context. It's not. Not to me. I mean, it goes back to the claim that you're trying – the claim that you're trying to assess the validity of.
Well, I don't know that they were trying to assess the validity of that claim, though.
Well,
right? Is that what they said?
At least that's the way they set up this paper. I mean, they set it up like that. And maybe I'm reading between the lines too much, and perhaps that's not – maybe I'm overinterpreting.
Sure.
I'm doing exactly the thing that I'm criticizing these papers for doing.
Yeah, okay. They do say that the study and others that followed bolstered the empirical case for a quote-unquote innate moral core – early developing set of abilities that allows infants to infer socio-morally relevant dispositions.
But the argument I want to make is that another reason choosing 15 months is the wrong age is because that's a hell of a lot of time to learn about socio-moral things in the world.
Yeah.
And so even if they show the effect, let's say they show the effect, we can't conclude. It's hard to know whether or not this effect is a function of some innate moral core or is a function of learning.
Yeah.
This is why it's paramount to me in these studies to test younger infants and to simplify the procedure in anticipation of the criticism that, oh, the reason you fail to show the finding is not because they lack or they don't possess the core in question, but rather because the procedures, for example, are too difficult or they have processing limitations. Well, but assuming you address that, you have to go younger
Let's push back and think about our conversation in our episode with David. Regardless of the age, like, is there any evidence, like, any younger age that would really make you believe that this claim of innate, like, is it even useful to make the claim that something is innate, which is what they're making? Because even if you tested newborn infants, would I really still, and you found this finding in some imaginary world,
right, because you learn in utero. Right, exactly. But I'm not making that up. So I am completely on board with that idea. I am a domain general researcher, and I subscribe to that perspective. I am just making the case that if the claim you want to make is that this thing is present, this thing is innate, then you have to test early. Now, of course, one can easily turn around and say, well, they may have learned that in utero. It becomes more difficult to make that claim for visual events.
Sure.
which this would be. Yep. And so if I were to see something like this at birth, I would be more inclined to believe that perhaps it is innate. Again, because, you know, what visual evidence would they have to learn about? Because the claim, so I described the computational model I built, that's based on visual evidence.
Sure. Yeah.
And so in the absence of that, it's not clear why, how this would come
would
to emerge through a learning account.
Yeah.
Right. And so this would be a domain where it would be useful, and this is why I keep pushing back about this, like, that's why it would be useful to test younger infants.
Yeah, I think it's exactly what you're saying, though, is the age, the getting hung up on the age thing depends on the claim that you're trying to assess. Like, if they're not trying to really assess the claim of innateness, and they're just trying to see, like, oh, does this finding also replicate with older kids? Like, I'm not trying to test whether or not it's an innate ability. Rather, I'm trying to test if children of different ages show the same preference for helpers versus hinderers and making this socio-moral judgment. Like, I do think it adds to that conversation. It doesn't add to the innate conversation. I wouldn't take it as evidence of that. I would say that it would tell us something then just about socio-moral judgments in 15-month-old infants.
But why would you expect for a 15-month-old not to, like, show at least rudimentary sensitivity to, social moral.
I would not expect that. I mean, and that's just my perspective from work.
Well, that's why I said rudimentary.
Yeah, from working with older children, like even preschoolers, we don't find those exact. We don't find those same things. So, like, as a researcher, from my perspective of working with older children, that wouldn't be my assumption that a 15-month-old would prefer helpers over hinderers in that specific type of design. I think also that there's probably different relations developmentally around how. Like, that actual display is probably interpreted. And so whether that's, like, younger infants taking away something about more perceptual differences of things coming together or going apart or whatever it might be versus the intentions that we ascribe to those agents in the display, I think that probably changes across development in various stages, like from earlier infancy, later infancy, into toddlerhood and preschoolers. There's probably different interpretations of that. So it wouldn't be my assumption, right? Like, I wouldn't know. I would have to, I would have to do more research and see what happens across development and do actual developmental studies that look at children of different age groups.
Right. Well, so I will give Kylie and Wayne and Loom some credit because they do test at least 2 ages.
Yeah, I know, which is good.
So there is a bit, this is a developmental study. Yeah. The one thing I will say, another thing I'll say, which is why I think it's important to exercise caution before accepting the claims, is that even within her own studies, she's showing different patterns of looking. So let's just take looking as an example. Yeah. So in the study that we discussed, the 07 paper, the infants looked longer when the climber approached the hinderer. Mm-hmm. Well, she also has other studies where the infants look longer when the climber approaches the helper.
Yeah.
How are we to reconcile those two patterns of looking? If the claim you're making is that they have this innate moral core that stipulates the principles that govern moral agents, and what this core does, what this mechanism does, is it alerts them to violations of morality, then it's hard for me to interpret, to understand, to sort of surmise the meaning of longer looking to an event in which the climber approaches the helper, right? If anything, I feel like the mechanism, this core system, this core moral system would alert the infant to a violation and therefore drive their looking towards the event where the climber approaches the hinderer. Mm-hmm. But that's not what she shows in some studies.
Yeah.
And so even within her own studies, it's not clear how to interpret the data on the whole.
Yep.
Moreover, much less sort of interpret these data as providing strong sort of support for the claim of the existence of some innate moral core. So that is another issue that I noticed in reading some of the studies. It's like they show different patterns of looking, but yet they're all interpreted the same way.
Yeah, and I think that they're we mentioned this one replication attempt, but there are many others too. Like, other people have tried to replicate these findings Or did conceptual replications by adding additional controls or looking at various different features, different methodological details, and found that those very minor methodological details matter quite a bit, like things like the balancing event. There's some evidence there from Scarf's paper. And then also, even with the other methodology of not using the climbers, but the opening and closing sort of study with the helpers and hinderers there.
Yep.
There's also replication attempts of that work that, again, if you use exactly the same procedure, you see some replication. This is by Salvadori and colleagues. And that one of our same researchers from this replication that we're talking about, Dennis Titone, and they don't replicate when they have other minor methodological differences. So I think it's just like, we really need to dig into that and find what those are and why do they matter, and how do they matter maybe even across age groups.
Right, exactly. I should also say, because I can anticipate an objection on Twitter. The mechanistic account that I outlined at the very beginning relies on infants showing sensitivity to these low-level perceptual features. Mm-hmm. Well, if that's the case, I can see one objection being, well, if that's the case, then why do the infants not show, differentiate between the test events when a pincer is used?
Yeah.
As opposed to...
inanimate. They use it.
Yeah, it was an inanimate pincer.
I think a circle, too. Like, just a geometric circle that doesn't have eyes. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And even there, that's not I don't see that as much of a challenge because my argument, again, just to be clear, is that this expectation that things that agents move together are more likely to move together rather than against each other is based on the idea that you have two agents with eyes.
Yeah.
And so failing to show an effect where one of the things is an inanimate object doesn't invalidate my argument.
Yeah.
Again, because my argument fundamentally rests on the presence of two agents, which therefore would trigger the expectation, the associative link.
That there's causality assumptions when we're looking at agents that are perceived to be animate agents with goals and intentions versus inanimate agents. And so you wouldn't have those same associations of coming together or moving in concordance with one another with inanimate objects, whereas we do.
Exactly. It's not going to trigger the expectation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this mechanism is hinges on the two agents triggering that associative link. But I thought it was important to mention that because, I mean, by not mentioning it, I don't think we would be giving a fair reading of what their counter arguments could possibly be. And that is one valid counter argument. But again, my rejoinder is that, well, you know, this pattern of looking is a function of is driven by the mere presence of two things with eyes. And now, so another objection they may have is, and someone may raise is that, oh, well, how does that explanation account for the helping hindering events that involve lifting up lids? But I think the same explanation applies.
Yeah.
Like in the real world, infants are more likely to see agents helping each other out by lifting up lids than agents moving in opposition to each other, acting in opposition to each other. And so, interestingly enough, this account makes another prediction that can be easily tested. Mm-hmm. So it merely predicts that two things move together, not necessarily that they have to be physically touching and move together.
Yeah.
And so an interesting test of this prediction would be to show the exact same events, but remove the contact.
Yeah.
And so if this expectation is based on a preponderance of experience with events where things move in the same direction, then you should expect the same patterns of looking. Mm-hmm. That is, they should still look longer at an event where two things act in opposition, even if there is no direct contact between the two. But again, this is also something that hasn't been tested. But to be charitable, to be fair, I don't think this is an alternative explanation that's been considered.
I think that they did in her paper that we looked at in their last experiment where they did have a neutral condition where it's a neutral character that doesn't interact with the climber but traces a path identical to the helper or the hinderer. But I don't think that they're necessary.
Let's take that.
Yeah, they're not necessarily, they're not moving together though, right? Like, they're separated, but they're moving in the same direction. But they're not like, do you know what I mean? They're not like moving together.
No, this is great. Let's go down this path. So here's another situation where, a person who's doing a fair reading of this literature, of this work, can easily say, okay, how does your account also explain experiment three? Well, it explains experiment three this way. So it, again, this all goes back to their real world experience, hinges on their real world experience. So as a reminder to the listeners, because we've talked about this at the very beginning of the episode, the pattern of, so in experiment three, the infants were habituated to alternating helper neutral events or hinderer neutral, or both actually were alternating. And what they show is that the infants who were habituated to helper neutral events prefer a helper over the neutral character, whereas those who were habituated to hinderer neutral events prefer the neutral character over the hinderer events. Well, so the way I would explain this finding in the context of my theoretical account is that in the real world, they're more likely to see events where things move together than, again, move in opposition. And they're also more likely to see those events than neutral events where two agents don't even interact. Like, it's a rare occurrence for two things to be in the same room and not to even acknowledge each other. Like, there's no interaction, there's no contingency. So even these events are much less frequent. Now, how do I account for the preference for the neutral over the opposition event? Well, in the same way, before I get into the explanation, I will say that this is all post hoc, and it would require a careful analysis of the kind of data that infants actually see.
Of course.
But my prediction is that they are more likely to see neutral events where two things are simply sitting in the same room, for example, two agents are simply sitting in the same room, not interacting, than events where two things are acting in direct opposition to each other.
Yeah, it's like, and so different levels of familiarity, right? Like,
exactly,
the least familiar
exactly.
is things coming, like, working in opposition, sort of being in the same room but not interacting, and then, like, moving in concordance or together is, like, the most familiar.
Exactly. And so on the basis of this this, I would sort of predict exactly what they're showing.
Yep.
And actually, I should mention, so the one claim I made earlier was that the prediction of the associative account is that younger infants who have less experience in the world with these kinds of events should fail to discriminate. And that's exactly what the six-month-olds, when you look at the looking time data, that's exactly what they're showing. They fail to discriminate.
Yep.
Well, that's exactly what the associative account that I outlined predicts.
Yep.
And so on the basis of that and these other differences that we discuss, it's really, I think it begs the question, are they really getting at an innate moral core rather than sensitivity to low-level perceptual features that happen to be confounded with morality, the manipulation of morality?
Yeah, I would be like even... I'd give more like weight to the idea that like maybe this is about moral judgments. I do think that infants, based on some of the work and again the differences between studies with like eyes as stimuli and like whether or not infants maybe are perceiving these as causal agents, like I do see maybe some more evidence for that. I'm not really interested in the idea of it being innate. Like, I really don't think it matters to the conversation. I think that there's a lot of things that can be learned. And, like, I don't know why we have to hinge this conversation on that. Like, I think that if you had framed the entire body of work as, like, we're presenting evidence that at a young age, whether it's innate or learned, infants are making some sort of socio-moral judgments, like, I think that that's a great body of work that you've presented to show some evidence for that. We still need some more work, but... I think that's really what we should be focused on rather than trying to prove some debate of whether or not something is innate.
Yeah, I agree. But such is the field.
Right?
Whether we like it or not, that's just the way developmental psychology is, especially infant developmental psychology.
Yeah, I know. I think that I'm a little bit more removed from that because like once you start studying preschoolers and like middle-aged kids, you know, we're not really interested in those debates. There might be some more people talking about like whether things are genetically based or genetic influences on outcomes versus, our sort of nurture parents and schools and things like that, yeah. and what percentage of genetics versus environment accounts for certain outcomes, but not necessarily this idea of just, like, is some type of knowledge innate, right? And this is sort of a different conversation.
So my experience, so I've done a little bit of work with preschool age children, and you're right that the questions there, the issues aren't about whether or not their knowledge is innate. I mean, these are preschool age children. At least from my reading of the literature, the questions are more about the nature of the mechanism, how sophisticated the mechanisms are that drive learning. So although the debate, although the question isn't about with preschool children whether or not some kind of knowledge is innate, there is still trenchant debate about the nature of the mechanism and how sophisticated the mechanism needs to be.
Or, I mean, what type of mechanism is it, like, an internal cognitive mechanism, or is it like a societal mechanism, like a societal influence? Like, mechanism can be social mechanism. So,
This goes back to my question, my sort of our conversation with Ava about different kinds of mechanisms. Yep. I mean, you know, you got to be careful about you. I think it's important to be clear about the mechanism in question. Are we talking about a mental mechanism, an external mechanism? But yeah, this has been
it's a good one.
A very fun. This is a good conversation.
We have a lot to talk about in this area. Maybe someday we will do another episode. This is such a vast literature on this topic, so I want to just recognize to all of our listeners that we certainly did not cover every study or paper on this topic.
Right.
We understand that, and we'll probably come back to this topic in the future and look at some other papers that are relevant as well.
It would actually be, I think it would be fun, and I'm sure the listeners would like this as well, is if we were revisit these topics, we actually invite those authors.
It's Kylie, like revisiting Hamlin.
Kylie, if you're listening, we would love to have a conversation with you about this work.
Absolutely, would love
to. I doubt that we'll be able to get Wynn, because I think she's out of academia, but I mean, we can get someone who's done that work or who subscribes to that perspective.
We would love anybody who has done any of the work that we've talked about who would be interested.
Right.
If you're listening, tweet us, send us a message, email us. We would love to have you and to join in and have more perspectives on these topics. That's really what this podcast is about, trying to hear everybody's varying ideas on these ideas of innateness. So we really appreciate you all listening today. I hope that you enjoyed it.
Before we go, don't forget to follow us. Like Candy was saying, don't forget to follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @theitsinnatePC.
Yeah.
And then if you have any questions or would like to, you know, potentially be featured on the podcast, be interviewed on the podcast, you can email us at, and I am blanking again. Let me look this up. Oh. All right, I got to get it down. theitsinnatepodcast@gmail.com. The reason I get confused is because our Twitter handle is PC, but then our email is podcast.
Twitter handle was limited in characters, so we couldn't write the whole thing out.
Right.
So
follow us
on Twitter, you message us on Twitter, email us, however, get in touch with us. We'd love to have some different voices on here, so we appreciate it. Thank you all.
Yeah. Until next time. Thanks.